Well, hello out there to everyone and all you constant listeners. This is Nick Deolius. I am coming at you from my global worldwide headquarters in beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I hope everything's going fine and smooth in your world. The taping of this podcast coincides with the official end of summer. It's hard to believe that the summer of 2021 has already come and gone, but there you have it. Hope you had an awesome summer. I did, and I hope you and your family enjoyed the same. This episode of the Far Middle podcast, which is episode number 16, is going to attempt to maintain, preserve that one trait that we had in the prior podcast, whether they were prior Far Middle podcast talking about chapters in my upcoming book, The Leech, or whether it was last episode number 15, where it was the first standalone Far Middle podcast that went about discussing a couple of topics and issues. And that theme or that trait is going to be the connecting of dots. I'm going to take two or three different issues that are out there today to speak about on this podcast and then try to draw them together into sort of a coherent manner at the end of the podcast. And it brought to mind when I was sort of preparing mentally for the podcast in this episode, brought to mind a favorite prior program documentary series that I just was obsessed with as a kid and watch it still to this day from time to time. And the series, the documentary series was labeled or titled Connections. And interestingly, this wasn't a US or American program. This was from the BBC, so it was British. And the host was a gentleman by the name of James Burke, a scientist. And Connections, which I think ran three seasons, started in the late 70s, probably around 78 or 79. And if you watch these episodes, you get the immediate feel for sort of the 70s, from how James Burke is dressed in the different episodes to just the overall granularity of the film. It's a pretty cool series to go back in time and watch. But the whole premise of the episodes, and you can watch these episodes independently. You don't have to watch them sequentially or, you know, season one and season two. You can watch them all individually. The beauty, or one of the beauties of Connections, was that it stood on its own episode by episode independently. But if you'd watch these episodes, what he would do would, he would start the episode with a technological innovation or two of the modern day. So he would show a jet airliner, or he would show a computer or something like that. And then he would start the episode and the story going back hundreds, or in some instances, thousands of years prior to modern day, and talking about individual technological advancements and developments, or revolutionary breakthroughs. And then linking each of these individual pieces from way back in history to the next thing and to the next thing. So this invention spurred or catalyzed the new creation, which then further spurred a further development, and so on. And over the course of the hour or so, he told the story of how one thing led to another, sometimes intended consequences, sometimes unintended consequences, and ultimately it led to the modern day innovation that he started the episode with, whether it was the jet airliner or the computer or whatever it was for that episode. And the point that he was making, besides it being richly entertaining when you tell the story that way, I think the point that he was making across all the individual episodes and across all the multi-seasons of Connections, James Burke was basically saying that if you take the modern day, you really can't look at any piece of it in a vacuum, by itself, in isolation. Instead, when you look at the modern world and you look at today, it consists of a bunch of interconnected events. And basically, that goes back to this theme of connecting dots. So again, whether it's the overall theme of the upcoming book, The Leech, and how these look to be separate issues of, say, the Federal Reserve or academia, or, you know, what's going on with respect to leadership in areas of our country or urban areas and so on, they are all in some ways interrelated, especially when it comes to the consequences, intended or unintended, that they spur. Same issue with technology, and I think that's the point that James Burke was making with Connections. So give it a look on maybe a view on YouTube or however you stream. Check out Connections by James Burke. I've got a season or two on DVD. Yes, I still watch and view DVDs. I've got a DVD collection of movies and documentaries like Connections. And also, of course, Twitter, if you want to follow me, if you dare to follow me on Twitter, at Nick Deolius, website nickdeolius.com. Please check into it from time to time. Have been adding content. I hope you find it interesting if you invest the time to give it a read. So one of the issues I want to bring up on this podcast for the far middle is just an overarching view on where we're at with respect to culture, and specifically when it comes to culture and culture of work. Someone I ran into a couple of days back that was perusing through the website, had listened actually to a couple of podcasts, said, you know, I didn't realize you were such an intellectual, Nick. And I sort of looked at the individual and said, intellectual? Why would you ever, you know, call me an intellectual? I almost took it as a bit of an insult. But when I got to thinking about it, I think all of us are intellectuals to varying degrees, because a man or a woman who is willing to think, and think maybe even ideally, rationally, objectively, probably fits the definition of an intellectual. So I tend to equate or maybe stereotype intellectuals as academics and degreed, maybe degreed from elite institutions, the Ivy League, or institutions along the lines of the Ivy League, maybe working in some sort of white-collar profession, right? But I don't think that needs to be the case when you just give a couple of moments of thought to what actually constitutes intellectual thought and an intellectual. If you are free thinking and you are ready, willing, and able to engage in that type of thought on a rational and an objective basis, indeed, you are an intellectual. So I suppose guilty is charged with being an intellectual, but aren't we all? And isn't that a great thing? Now, thinking about these issues, these broader issues intellectually, it brought me to the topic of work and the importance that work has played in the American culture and our American experience through our history, and also to the individual, you know, what it's done for individual fulfillment, achievement, happiness, those types of things. Which brought me to another person, if you've been listening to these podcasts, you know that I'm a big fan of, which is Ayn Rand, who back in the 60s, and I think it was published perhaps in the 70s, it got published later, she put out a really interesting paragraph or so on the difference between what she was labeling the career man versus the job holder. And I think this speaks to the issue of work and how it fits into our national fabric as a value, so to speak. So she said the difference between a career man and a job holder is as follows. A career man regards his work as constant progress, is a constant upward motion from one achievement to another, driven by the constant expansion of his mind, his knowledge, his ability, his creative ingenuity, never stopping to stagnate on any level. A job holder regards his work as a punishment imposed on him by the incomprehensible malevolence of reality or of society, which somehow does not let him exist without effort. So his policy is to go through the least amount of motions demanded of him by somebody and to stay put in any job or drift off to another wherever chance, circumstance, or relatives might happen to push him. So I think she did an awesome job once again. That was her strong suit, of course, right? Articulating these types of views and contrasts and differentiations, did a wonderful job of summarizing when work becomes an underlying value within a culture. That's sort of what she deemed the career man. And, you know, contrasting that to how someone who just views a job as nothing more than a job and tries to do the bare minimum to get through that, to get onto other things or to survive it, almost viewing it, as she put it, as punishment on the other side of the spectrum. You know, having a nation and a people and a culture that embraces the former view of work versus the latter makes a massive difference with respect to competitiveness, with efficiency, with quality of life, all of those things. And again, individually for the person by person, but also collectively when it comes to the nation or the region or the economy, whatever you want to define in the aggregate. This matters incredibly. And I take what Rand was thinking and writing upon and then sort of applying that with what we've seen recently, modern day, particularly in 2021 with pandemic and shutdowns and government policy, you know, sort of intervening in the middle of it. And I just wonder, at the end of the day, work as a value, or the work ethic, the American work ethic, is it dead? I ask that in the past tense as in dead versus dying, because I fear that it may be worse than even a question of asking whether it's dying. It might be already a fait accompli in that it's dead. And I see different examples of this that stoked that question in my mind that I wanted to put out to all of you for consideration as well. I mean, one was this debate, and it's been a debate that we've seen for decades, economics, right, about minimum wage. Raising minimum wage, is it helpful? Is it hurtful? That's an economic debate that that micro and macro economists and Keynesians and other economic schools of thought have been battling over for, as I said, decades. I've got my views. In the end, I think that the free market is the best arbiter of where wages will go. If you really want to help grow entry-level jobs and entry-level pathways into the middle class, the last thing in the world you want is government dictating what the price controls will be on things like wages. That's going to deter economic growth and hurt the middle class and the working poor the hardest. But that's just my opinion. I know there's others that have other views of that. But what was interesting was not necessarily where you fall out on the minimum wage debate. It was what happened when we looked at the sort of debate taking center stage in our national politics and our national economy. So you've got people like President Biden, the Democrats that are advocating for raising the minimum wage, and also to some extent looking at all the stimulus and all the support the government had provided, which almost created a disincentive to work. We've heard that terminology quite a bit recently, and sort of being proud of that because their view was, well, if it creates a disincentive to work, maybe then employers need to offer more in wage rate to get workers back to the workforce. Thus, it's sort of a backdoor or a hidden way to raise the minimum wage without actually having an official, discrete minimum wage piece of legislation. But what was really interesting was if you're in the real economy and you're looking to continually hire and replace workers that you lose through attrition, retirement, going to a different job, just stopping work, whatever the case might be, it is incredibly difficult today to get people to show up for work. And this isn't an entry-level job issue. I'm not talking about sort of jobs that pay at or slightly above minimum wage thresholds. I'm talking about the gamut. I'm talking about well and high-paying blue-collar jobs, high-paying white-collar jobs, remote work, in-person work, all of the above. Work in traditional line economies like manufacturing, work in the idea economy, sort of the new economy. Doesn't matter. There is a situation today, sort of an epidemic or a movement, I'd call it, where a lot of individuals simply just refuse to go to work. And that, from my perspective, is hugely troubling. That's something that I worry about because the reason that they don't have that drive in some instances to go to work or to get to work is that there's been something that's replaced that as a safety net, which of course is government. So you got two problems here. One, we're losing that work as a value, that work ethic, which created the quality of life that we enjoy today as Americans and then across the globe. And at the same time, we are worse yet replacing that, substituting that with the dependency on government, which is never a good thing. And I think COVID, pandemic, shutdown, it exacerbated this issue. It created an opportunity for those looking for these two things to happen, the erosion of our work ethic and the replacing of work with government dependency. It created a catalyst for those individuals and those people that sort of have those thoughts and views to accelerate these things. And at the same time, it also creates, I think, a higher level of societal angst. And what I mean by that is if you're not busy, and you're not working and you're not endeavoring upon a career, right, or a profession, then what do you do in lieu of that? Well, if you, on top of it, with pandemic, you can't go anywhere, you can't travel, you can't do anything, you're basically sitting at home. And what are you doing when you're sitting at home? You're sitting online, you're all over social media, you're watching the news. You take social media, online, news, and you add them all together in sort of a all waking hours type of an environment 7 days a week, it's going to give you a negative outlook and it's going to be a demotivator for achievement. And in the end, it's going to increase the overall threshold of societal angst to the point where, you know, things start to break down. And I think we've started to see some of that, whether you look at safety statistics, whether you look at certain economic statistics, and just whether you look at the overall sense of where we are as a people, as a nation. Now, you know, don't take my word for it that work ethic, work as a value, the dignity of work are great things. Take someone else's word for it, specifically Pope John Paul II and all the great things he did. Well, one of the great things that he did, 1981, he put out an encyclical. We talked in a prior podcast about Pope Francis's environmental encyclical, which is fraught with all kinds of pitfalls, and I am not a proponent of. I'm a harsh critic of that, as you know. But Pope John Paul II, back in 81, put out an awesome encyclical, which discussed work. What he said in that encyclical was, quote, "Work is a good thing for man, a good thing for his humanity, because through work, man not only transforms nature, adapting it to his own needs, but he also achieves fulfillment as a human being and indeed, in a sense, becomes more a human being." How true. And what I really love within that little excerpt I just quoted from Pope John Paul II was when he said, because through work, man not only transforms nature, adapting it to his own needs. Think about that. That's the way we used to view things, which is another way of saying humans and the quality of life that humans enjoy come first. The earth or Mother Earth comes second. That was the way we viewed things as a people and as humans not long ago in 1981. Think of how contrasting that is to Pope Francis's view of where humans rank relative to Mother Earth, so to speak, a complete 180. How unfortunate is that? But this sort of takes that dot that we're talking about of work as a value and the dignity of work ethic, and how people approach that today in the United States. And now I'm going to try to connect it to another dot, which is this issue that I've sort of hinted upon a couple of minutes prior, which is pandemic and COVID. Because I think what's happened is that you've seen the pandemic hit, you saw the economic shutdowns that occurred, which then, so government, and again, what I reference as sort of elites could be the idea economy, so big tech, academia, right? Obviously government bureaucracy, the media, the mainstream media, those types of stakeholders and institutions. So people that basically sort of work with their mind, work on a keyboard, right? They're not out and doing something with their hands. They don't even have to show up face-to-face to go about their work or their career or their profession. They saw this in many ways, frankly, as an opportunity. And what was the opportunity to do? Well, we've got a health crisis. So let's mandate an across-the-board, heavy-handed shutdown of all activity, force everyone back into their homes and force them into sort of suspended inactivity. And then as government and as stakeholders that make decisions and can sort of package those decisions into favorable ways and advocacy, right? Let's then have that shutdown and that economic distress that ensues. Let's have that be used to justify all kinds of government intervention economically and from a policy and from a fiscal and from a spending perspective and from a monetary policy perspective. And once we do that, let's do that in a way where we can disincentivize, demotivate work, and basically create a system and an infrastructure of dollars and cents where it doesn't make sense anymore. It's easy for people not to go to work or not to get off the couch or not to jump off of social media and start to engage face to face. And you see this with pandemic, not just with shutdowns, and not just with a split between, you know, those who work face-to-face or work with their hands at a location versus those who are in the idea economy. You see it also with respect to things like masks and what they can do and how they can basically create buffers between people looking to communicate, express, work, and endeavor. And again, I'm not an opponent of masks. I think if the data and the science and the medicine say that it helps, then we should apply that in the right instances and the right circumstances. So I don't want to give the impression that I'm some sort of like extreme anti-masker or something like that. But it's yet another tool that helped, like fiscal policy, like quote-unquote COVID relief, like the shutdowns, that were able to be utilized by those looking to, I believe, demote and demoralize the work ethic within this country. And to a large extent, I fear through 2020 and 2021, they've been largely successful in that effort. So government policy that pays people not to work, I don't think that's a good thing in any environment and should only be used in the direst of circumstances or emergency situations. And certainly now looking at what's happened late 19, 20, and 21, we have far passed that point. Yes, there's still major challenges with COVID and Delta and all the future coming variants. But by and large, the ability for people who aren't at risk and that are vaccinated to go out and work in our profession and pursue their career and interact with other human beings in the real world economy, that opportunity is largely there in a very, very low risk, if not risk-free way. And policy that precludes that or that deters that, well, that's wrongheaded. And I believe it's not wrongheaded by accident. I think it's wrongheaded by design because they're solving those people that are advocating for those policies or trying to solve for something different, which is, again, to evaporate, erode, diminish the work ethic of the country. And I referenced a couple of minutes ago the science. If the science says this, right, how many times have you heard that the past couple of years with a pandemic? I think, again, connecting now to yet another dot with this episode of The Far Middle, you see science really being exposed with respect to what it's become versus what it was. And I think science right now sort of exists in two spheres. And you had Matt Ridley, who's a great writer that basically, I think, summarized this issue in a really succinct, clear way. He points out a distinction between what he calls science as a philosophy and then science as an institution. So he says the two of those, science as philosophy versus science as institution, two very different things. Science as a philosophy, really great thing. That came out of the Enlightenment. I talked about the Enlightenment a bit in my book, The Leech, that was just an epic, you know, impact on the human condition that we enjoy to this day. And obviously, when science is viewed as a philosophy, that's basically putting rational and objective reason at the forefront of everything. So definitely all in and a supporter of science as philosophy. But, you know, science as institution, Ridley points out that all institutions, they are erratic. You know, they're going to be falling short of stated principles from time to time. They're suspect because they're run by human beings. And human beings are inherently entities and creatures that are far from perfect. So what he saw happening, and I agree with him on this, is that this COVID situation and the shutdown and what to do with masks and what to do with vaccines and boosters and variants and who's at risk and who's not and all these debates that we've seen ensued, it basically has put science and definitely put it to the fore, but put it to the fore of everyone's eyes and ears where you're seeing this split real time. You're seeing the science as a philosophy sort of being pushed down, submerged, subsumed by mainstream media, by academia, by bureaucrats in government that are looking for certain outcomes and social designs. And science as an institution, right, being elevated. And that sort of the moting of science as a philosophy and the elevating of science as an institution, that is a horribly bad thing for not just the United States and not just our economy, but again, for the human condition. And what's infuriating to me in all of this, and I do consider myself a scientist, I'm an engineer, so call it STEM, call it science, call it engineering, but I consider myself part of the community, perhaps not the brightest member of the community, but I'm in there nonetheless. What's been, you know, making me just furious about this issue, science as an institution being elevated, is that elevation and the demotion of science as a philosophy, it's come from within. It's come from scientists themselves. Now, I don't know exactly why that is the case. I've got, you know, different theories or thoughts, but I really can't sort of prove or disprove my hypotheses. But one that I'm leaning toward more and more, that again, you saw with COVID, you saw with pandemic, is this issue of did COVID or did COVID not leak from a lab in China, in Wuhan? And that seems like a very simple question. But maybe, and you've seen the pushback on this issue where you've almost created this level of we're not even going to talk about that. To even mention that, you're a Cro-Magnon, you're not enlightened, you may even be racist, you could even be labeled as racist. I've seen that at times. we're not going to discuss even that concept of possibly occurring. Now, that's changed somewhat since the facts, right, and the reality have come to light. But I think the reason that you saw that sort of violent response to even questioning where the origins of COVID came from was that if indeed it was leaked accidentally from a lab, a scientific lab, well, then that's going to be a black eye for science. And the scientific community as an institution doesn't want that. Well, that's again, a human trait that you see in business when business leaders go awry. That's a human trait you see with politicians when political leaders become crooked and do things. We're seeing some of that with nursing homes in New York State and COVID, right? So this is, again, this is a fault of the human condition, and scientists are human beings. And thus, it's not surprising if you see a situation where the truth might give a black eye reputationally to science, that there's going to be a tendency by scientists to push that down, make that go away, not discuss it, not entertain any inquiry or debate with respect to it. And then once you've got science as an institution to the fore, pushing down science as a philosophy and the rationale and reason that goes with science as a philosophy, then that's a slippery slope. So now then it's not going to be surprising to see some of the other things that we've observed across the scientific community with COVID and pandemic. So what you see is now it's not a big leap for scientists or a scientist or a scientific organization to start to push certain views that are consistent with their political beliefs or their philosophical beliefs, despite what rational thought, facts, and the science might say as a philosophy, so to speak. And that's when science starts to sway into and wade into these political arenas, and science becomes more of a political weapon than anything else. So when people and politicians start talking about, quote unquote, the science, everyone just shrugs their shoulders and rolls their eyes because they know that's not science as we think of it as a philosophy. That's science being abused, utilized, depending on your view, as an institution, as a political tool. And you see this also beyond COVID, of course. You see with climate. I mean, we'll talk about this with climate change all the time, where, you know, climate change and the whole issue with respect to it, very similar, right, to COVID and what the origins of COVID were, or some of these decisions on the medical side with COVID. It becomes very much a political issue, not a scientific one. And that does great harm to the reputation of scientists and the scientific community. You also see on this slippery slope, not just then scientists and the scientific community getting into politics and being sort of tarnished, sullied by politics and their reputations along with it, but you see this issue of conformity. You need to sort of fit in. And from my perspective, I've talked about this before, I think, with you on prior podcasts, science is not about consensus. Science is about breaking, challenging, fighting the consensus. That's how all great scientific breakthroughs had occurred. Again, going back to James Burke and Connections, his documentary series and those seasons and those episodes are just chock full of people where everyone in the community, everybody in the know was saying one way, and the individual said, heck no, I'm going to do this a different way, or I view it a different way. And indeed, they ended up being right and vindicated. So science is not about conformity. But again, today, science is an institution. It's all about conformity. So disagreement, challenging, which basically are the catalyst for scientific progress, they get pushed to the back, which means scientific progress itself gets pushed to the back. And, you know, some people call that groupthink. They'll reference it as groupthink. I do that as well from time to time. But that groupthink, when science becomes an institution, and then you couple it with how scientific views and thoughts are published and disseminated today, like the peer review process for journal article submissions and research papers, now you can see where this looks more like the consensus building in a high school classroom, right, with peer pressure than it does with respect to the scientific method and scientific inquiry the way it was meant to be as a philosophy. And I think one of the best examples of this that you saw with COVID in the pandemic was when I want to say it was back in February, maybe March, a bit earlier this year, you had one of those famous institutions that are notorious for elevating science as an institution versus a philosophy, the World Health Organization, you know, how much dirt on their hands do they have coming off of COVID over the past couple of years? But so you had the World Health Organization put together a group of a dozen or so scientists from the West. They went to China in February. They met with about a dozen or so Chinese scientists, and they did their studies. They met, they had their discussions, and they come out jointly at a press conference, and they said and pronounced to the world that this whole idea that COVID came out of a lab or leaked from a lab, I think the term they used, they labeled as extremely unlikely. And while they were labeling that extremely unlikely, you had Taiwanese scientists that were dealing with COVID as a crisis in very early, I want to say 2020. And they were saying that this looks like something very different. And not only that, we think it's a major epidemic because this human-to-human transmission is real. What did the World Health Organization say? You're from Taiwan, and not gonna consider what your thoughts are. So again, that's what happens when science becomes driven by, comes impacted by, takes its tune from politics and bureaucrats. Bad things happen. I think you can probably tell I'm not a fan of the World Health Organization. I wasn't a fan before COVID, less of a fan now. Any organization like that that wraps itself as a scientific organization and in early 1 year of 2020 is telling scientists from a certain country that is not favored or recognized by a big funder of the organization, the World Health Organization. So China, you know, Taiwanese scientists not favored by China, which is a big funder of World Health Organization, that your thoughts don't matter, that becomes not just problematic from, you know, a philosophical approach of science and scientific rationale and reason. It's resulted in God knows how many avoidable deaths over the world because of the delay mechanism of not getting a handle on this sooner rather than later. And then a year later, if you're looking at what's going on in early 21, that same institution invites again a team of Western scientists with Chinese scientists, and they come out and they suddenly proclaim that it's extremely unlikely that this came from a lab in Wuhan. I think the credibility of the World Health Organization is shot. It was shot for me long ago when they basically made their first and foremost objective, you know, looking at climate change. You would think the World Health Organization should be focused on things like pandemic, right? Ebola and what's going on with COVID, those types of things. That's a massive threat to humanity and human life. But no, right now, from their perspective, the greatest threat to humanity is climate change. I favor to disagree on that in a big way. And when organizations, elite organizations like the World Health Organization, don't do their day job of, you know, looking at pandemics and getting in front of them instead of behind them, and instead, you know, focus on these long-term abstract issues that aren't within their core mission, like climate change, then it's not surprising that you get some of these outcomes that we saw with how we managed the COVID pandemic from a government and from a sort of bureaucratic elite perspective. And I think you saw two big themes out there when it came to how society managed COVID, at least in the West. One was the issue of what I would sort of define as coming up with the sort of singular focus of stopping the spread, but not considering the impact of what measures you would take to stop the spread, what impacts they would have on society, on people, on an economy, on those types of things that matter greatly, on human health itself. So with COVID, we're going to shut everything down. Let's take schools as an example. We're going to shut schools down. And that's going to help stop the spread. That's what we want to do. But yet there was no consideration, and there continues the struggle to consider the consequences of what the harm will be of that mitigation measure of shuttering schools. If we see any sort of hybrid learning or remote learning this calendar school year now coming up in the fall of 21, that will be now three academic calendars impacted by COVID. And that cumulatively is going to take a massive toll on that student body, a generation, frankly. And it's a group of a demographic that stands at very low risk to having, you know, some sort of dire health impacts, adverse impacts of COVID. They're not an at-risk population by any stretch. And then you couple that issue of not considering the mitigating measures and the harm they may be doing to quote unquote stop the spread. You couple that with the second theme that I've noticed, which is, and we deal with this all the time in the energy industry, this issue of risk management, where suddenly COVID pandemic has become something where zero risk is the only tolerable outcome, the only tolerable path, which is completely counter to everything else we do in life. Every time we get in an automobile, every time we get on an airplane, every time we eat fast food, every time we do just about any activity in life that you can think of, we're taking on risk. There are a statistical certainty that might be a low level, right, of risk, but there's nonetheless a statistical certainty, some level of risk that an injury or a fatality can occur. Heck, I think there's even tens of thousands of people who die at home every year, just being at home, basically. So everything in life has risk. But yet when it comes to how we decided or we were told to manage and navigate through COVID and pandemic, the answer has been, we're going to do this in a way where there's zero risk. We're going to take on zero risk path, which basically brings everything in life to a grinding halt and all the consequences that go with it. And I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm vaccinated. I'm not, I don't think that COVID is a fiction. It's real. People have died. People are dying from it. No doubt about those things. I also, however, believe that our approach to this, or the way we've been instructed to view it and manage it, has been completely wrongheaded, and that there were some underlying agendas at play that once again used pandemic as an opportunity to further those institutions or those stakeholders' ultimate aims when it comes to policy and just overall culture. So who were those institutions? It's the same ones we've been talking about over prior episodes. It's the elite of institutions that are out there. You see it. I mentioned mainstream media, academia for certain, these bureaucratic organizations like World Health, United Nations. Obviously, government needs to be included in that. But what you see when those stakeholders and institutions start to elevate science as an institution and they politicize science, well, now what you get into, not only is scientific progress deterred, not only do you come up with very inefficient, harmful ways to navigate something like a pandemic, well, now all of a sudden, before you know it, and this is one of the sort of hidden agendas, I believe, of these institutions. Now, all of a sudden, if you say what you think, and if you are scientifically inquisitive and you want to express opinion, all of a sudden now, when you say what you believe to be the truth, now you're at risk for being labeled something that's not a positive and basically being suppressed with respect to your thoughts and views. But I don't want to be impacted by that. I want to be able to say what I think when it comes to my view of the objective impacts, good or bad, in terms of how we navigated through a pandemic. And I think in total, when I look at things objectively, and I believe rationally, I think many of our policies, and when you look at them cumulatively, they've hurt certain stakeholders big time, particularly children and families and the middle class. I think those are three big sort of casualty demographics of how we've navigated through pandemic. And worse yet, a lot of what we were aiming for with these draconian shutdowns and isolations and the different approaches we've taken, what we were aiming for, right, was to protect the at-risk, to protect the vulnerable, particularly the elderly. I think we did a horrible job with that. So worse than even, of course, having the harm done to demographics because it was heavy-handed in our approach, we didn't get the benefit that we were shooting for. And once again, I will reference different sort of demographics of elderly, nursing homes, different areas geographically like New York State, and what happened with respect to those individuals. It's almost criminal what's happened with respect to harming a whole swath of society because of heavy-handedness, and at the same time not getting anything close to the benefit that was advertised to go with the heavy-handedness. And the harm that some of these policies that we've implemented have done, it's hard to gauge and really wrap your arms around the magnitude of it. It's going to take some time for them to become clear, but we know it's going to be an ugly scenario. I even look at things that are quite serious that you would think were not at least directly or immediately affected by the policies put in place to navigate through pandemic, but yet they are. So think of cancer and cancer screenings. There's medical study after medical study that shows screenings really change the outcome in terms of when you detect cancers on the survivability of them and the mortality rate that they demand or extract on the person afflicted. So the sooner you get screened, the better for a whole bunch of outcomes. But if you took the data and the science, again, that we saw when it comes to cancer screenings and how that can be preventative in a good way, and then you superimpose that and look at the price of not screening to the time that we had shutdowns where basically you couldn't go do your preventative medicine and get your physicals and do your screenings, there's probably going to be close to 1 million new cancer cases over a 9-month period that went undetected. So that's a huge price to pay when it comes to the types of policies that we've embraced to navigate through COVID. And again, with little benefit on the back end of trying to protect the most vulnerable in society. I worry and I see statistics when it comes to things like suicide across society, depression, anxiety, and all of those mental ailments and diseases that are going to increase or have increased because of people being isolated, people not interacting, people not working, people not being able to go achieve. That's real. We talked about the impact on kids educationally. I don't even want to see. As you know, I've been very concerned about where math proficiency, reading proficiency, science proficiency, language proficiency sits with middle schoolers, high schoolers across the public school system in the United States, particularly in urban areas for working middle class, for poor kids from socioeconomic underserved communities. They're abysmal. That was before pandemic, before two calendar school years for sure, maybe, God forbid, a third coming up here that are affected by not having in-person learning. What are we doing to that generation of kids? That's our future. And to think of the cumulative impact they've had to shoulder because of this and what was already a bad situation when it comes to proficiency levels across these key skill sets academically, it's almost criminal what we've done to those kids. And then I think of, we want to think of unemployment and the economy being shuttered more economically, GDP and dollars and net wealth, that type of thing. And that stuff's real. And I'm tied into that and watch that very closely. That does improve the human condition. That's important stuff, no doubt. But there's also, going back to that first thought that we laid out there in this podcast, work is a virtue. Work is dignity. Work is a value. When you become unemployed or you lose your job or you lose the drive to go work, maybe by design, depending on who's putting out and implementing the policies, that is going to change your overall mental health. That's going to change your overall physical health. And that will take its toll when you look at life expectancies and mortality rates for all demographics, I believe, but probably hardest hit in the poorest of demographics over the coming years. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see material changes in life expectancy across a range of demographics and in things like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, depression, suicides, opioid addiction, all those things that go with individuals when they lose their drive, they lose their meaning to be and their reason to get up in the morning. Those are all foreseeable and those are all tangible impacts of the way that we've heavy-handedly navigated through pandemic and through COVID. And I believe that the scientific community that helped, aided, and abetted these other stakeholders to make science more of an institution and increasingly a political or religious institution instead of a philosophy of rationale and reason, I believe they are heavily involved as an accomplice in these negative outcomes that have occurred across our society, across our economy, and across our sort of human health spectrum within the United States and the world over. It really, and I hate to say this, it pains me to say this, but I feel as a scientist, as an engineer, that the scientific community has sort of become what Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, once said when he said, "A lie told once remains a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes the truth." Unfortunately, the scientific community has become an institution, a political flawed institution at that, almost bordering on a religion, and it continues to ignore truth, speculate on lies to the point where they make the mistruth become the truth. I think it's time now to head down the home stretch for this episode number 16 of the Far Middle Podcast. I've had actually two more items that I want to discuss. We'll save those for next week because, once again, every time I do this, we get these issues that are so interesting, so timely. I just end up taking more time on them than I originally thought or envisioned. But that's great. That's a good problem to have. So I think the takeaways, the dots that we discussed today, be an intellectual. Think. Right. If you think you are an intellectual, everybody should strive to be an intellectual. Continue to think. Be that career woman, that career man that Ayn Rand spoke about in a brightened way, and what that does for you in terms of pursuing interests and developing, expanding your horizons. Embrace that American work ethic. Work is a virtue. Work is dignity. If you don't have work in your life, you're going to be lacking for a lot that you can achieve with respect to your potential. Embrace science as a philosophy, not science as an institution. So fight whenever you see science acting as an institution or a religion. Fortify, embrace, encourage science when you see it being practiced as a philosophy and rationale and reason coming to the fore of the scientific method. Speak your mind. Challenge those elite stakeholders, right, when they're trying to make science the institution that it's rapidly becoming, when it's trying to erode the American work ethic, when they don't want you to be the intellectual, they just want you to do what they tell you to do. It doesn't matter if it's big tech, it doesn't matter if it's mainstream media, it doesn't matter if it's the government bureaucrat, it doesn't matter if it's academia. You're as intellectual as any of them. You got your right to think what you do and have science sort of be your navigator when you go about that thought journey. And get out there and achieve. I mean, this is a serious time, no doubt, with respect to COVID. It's real, but you need to get out there. You need to achieve. I'd ask you to consider to get vaccinated. And I would obviously encourage you to protect your at-risk loved ones to the best extent that you can. So be smart about it. But if you're smart about it and you're looking at the risk-reward analysis, it definitely pays to get out there and to interact and achieve and go create value. I hope you enjoyed episode 16. And if it leaves you for wanting a bit more, don't worry, because before you know it, we'll be back to you talking on the subjects and the dots for episode 17. I hope I did in this episode James Burke, the great James Burke of Connections fame. I hope I did him right, made him proud. But till then, talk to you soon and see you on episode 17.